Warning, this podcast contains bad words and stories about drugs and sex and overthrowing the government. Proceed with caution. Okay. Thank you. And now on to our show. Wake up, brother, we got nothing to do. Let's go outside, just me and you, and build a fort. We'll pack a lunch, won't be home till after dark. Then after dinner we can sneak back out. You know that high school girl I've been telling you about? Well, she gets undressed about a quarter to nine, and we can watch her do it from the big old pine next door. She got a room on the second floor. Well, looks like another fucked up day in paradise.
Hello?
Hey, hi.
Hi.
So, how's your...
How are you?
Hey, I'm great.
This is the Daughter of Godcast. Select stories from the 11-year campaign to shoot, edit, and distribute the narrative post-sci-fi featurette Daughter of God with myself, Dan Kelly, writer-director, and today joined by my excellent friend, Anne Loading, Daughter of God's line producer in Kingston, Ontario. I met Anne when she was dating my pal Mark, not Mark Dillon from episode 004.1, back in high school. She, of course, is much younger than me, like at least 10 years. So, let's see, that would have made her like 8 years old when she was dating Mark. I think the statute of limitations has probably run out by now, so Mark, you can rest easy if you're listening. Mark is a ghostbuster these days, or chud hunter. The rumors are conflicting. The last two episodes, I've been off in the weeds talking about gear and money. But before we return to the primary narrative back aboard the big boat in 2006, I feel compelled to muse about the inexplicable, the phenomenal. This is, after all, the Halloween episode. Daughter of God can be viewed as fiction, as a mashup of tropes from writers both revered and obscure, including Phil Dick, Michael Swanwick, Michael Crichton, Kurt Vonnegut, Cory Doctorow, H.G. Wells, James Blish, William Gibson, Neal Stephenson, Bruce Sterling, and anyone else who I've ever read, with a heavy infusion of genre movies both A and B. However, I want to offer another perspective for our mutual consideration. In the infinite variety of the multiverse, could Daughter of God be a true story? What if Werner Heisenberg had not been able to cripple the Nazi atomic program as he did in our timeline, and New York City had been taken out by a nuclear-tipped V-2 launched from a U-boat near Nantucket? What would that world look like in 2017? What if parallel realities are bundled together like fiber optic strands? What if each strand is a little leaky? What if nearby timelines can bleed over into ours, like radio stations on adjacent frequencies? If you've been tuning into Daughter of Godcast for a while, then you know I am not shy about acknowledging my extensive talents. But what if the gentle release isn't all me? Screenplay, cinematography, supporting actor, primary investor, composer, VFX director, editorial, podcast, web presence, social media. How likely is it that one person, albeit a brilliant, exceptional artist like myself, could pull all that off? Doesn't that seem kind of impossible? Is there an alternative explanation? In the words of Arthur Conan Doyle's Sherlock Holmes, once you eliminate the impossible, whatever remains, no matter how improbable, must be the truth. Well, running with this paradigm, the rift between our timeline and the universe next door seems to have recently widened. You may have been catching the odd snippets of poetry posted to Facebook, Twitter, Google+, LinkedIn, and occasionally Instagram via Buffer. I'm sure that's me filling Buffer's queue. It's gotta be, right? I must be making all that up and scheduling it to post. A couple years back, when my heart was breaking, I committed to roughly a year of posting only poetry on Facebook. Now, there's nothing supernatural about writing love poems. What's a little freaky is that I was full on with Daughter of God then too. If that's me posting the poetry today, was I being prepared to receive these current transmissions, warmed up like a dirt bike on a chill fall morning, expanded and reinforced to allow the full flow? Creation is being a fire hose and learning how to find the hydrants. We're all fancy tubes, a hookup between the ineffable and what's for breakfast. That high-pressure gush several stories high, that's the cosmos coming through, slaking the raging blaze of desire. Wait. If you're a hose and desire is a fire, then what's burning, who's the fire brigade, and why are you so obsessed with mixed metaphors, Dan Kelly? Is this a finger pointing to the moon, or just spooky, nonsensical bluster? Yes! I don't want to pull a Twin Peaks on you, and just keep opening up mystery after mystery without any supporting armature. I suspect there is an armature, an underlying structure that is discernible, and once perceived could trigger a boon or blooming. The Daughter of Godcast podcast started out as an exposition, what happened years ago making my movie. At least I thought I was making a movie. Now I'm not so sure. Time to roll forward on the primary narrative. In episode 006, we're ready to start production. Lights, camera, action, and all that. Current enigmatic musings and anecdotal evidence of strange happenings to be continued. The takeaway from today's little intro is just this. I don't have an explanation for the phenomena that is the gentle release. If you want to pretend it's all me, go right ahead. Episode 008, Pegging the Fun Meter. A key factor in deciding to shoot on a big boat was that this made the chances of Anne Loading coming along a lot more likely. She's into big boats, especially old, sunken, and or decrepit big boats. The past few years, she's been leading the effort to restore the Columbia, a steam-powered passenger ferry built in 1902 and originally based in Detroit, Michigan. In 2015, Anne and her team moved Columbia to Buffalo, New York, in preparation for eventual transport to the Hudson River via the St. Lawrence Seaway. Because Anne has a full plate between the Columbia in Buffalo and her family back in Kingston, New York, I knew she wouldn't be up to speed with the podcasting and my version of events. Her recollections would be pristine. After getting the latest news from Buffalo, Anne and I talked about her memories of production aboard the Alexander Henry in Kingston, Ontario, 10 years ago. She talked about having to fill the role of mom and how that was a little strange for her, having only been a mom herself for 9 months.
Feeling like very much like a mom, which of course I sort of was new at the time, but I don't know, it just felt very mommy, and you know, it was really weird for me.
The upstairs common room at the B&B where most of us slept, our flop house.
I vaguely remember the place that we stayed, with that room sort of where everybody was kind of flopping. And I remember going to the Salvation Army with Melanie and you know, to get stuff to dress set.
Her and Melanie trying to dress Christina's cabin with props from the Kingston Salvation Army and feeling frustrated at the lack of options.
Difficulty with getting good sound. I remember that was a problem, and I sort of remember
our struggles with recording sound and heavy reliance on lavalier radio mics, a boom operator being impractical in the low ceiling cabins with deep focus compositions, not to mention no boom operator. Take after take. Overloading the ship's electrical system and having to run our own generator.
Remember the generator, you know, trying to figure out how best to place the generator so that the sound didn't interfere with the shooting.
Wrangling with payments to the museum.
I vaguely remember some financial stuff with the museum where there were like checks, you know, coming and going.
Reviewing location agreements from our lawyer.
Some documents from, I think it was your lawyer, that they had to sign, which was, I guess, allowing the images of the boat to be used or something.
Shuttling the gang between the B&B and the boat for an 8 o'clock a.m. call.
I remember driving around a lot in a van. It takes people to and from to shoot. Every morning.
Her vague impression of Lena as being a consistently sane and calm presence, in contrast to everyone else who at some point was wound up and cranky, me especially.
I remember you being overwrought, like burning. It was like a light bulb, you know, 110 volt light bulb burning on like 240. You were like, and I remember watching you struggle to keep your set of bon ami.
My bon ami, Francais for good friend. Also a scrubbing powder made from feldspar. Pretty sure she meant the French.
And be a leader, but at the same time you're sort of overwhelmed and frustrated. And
this is what really interested me. Her impressions of my presence as a new director under extreme time and staff constraints.
It was hard getting everybody out in the morning. Remember, like, the call-out was, like, at 8 o'clock or something?
Yep.
And you're like, come on, let's go! And people, like, drag at me. And it was, like, a problem getting everybody to sleep at the right time. And it just was like a, you know, you were asking them to be more professional, and they weren't quite ready for it. And sometimes you were short-tempered, I mean, you know, because you were dealing with all these things.
Anne's perception was that the group was young and inexperienced, griping about trivia. She had logged many hours as a commercial captain, so the complaints of the Daughter of God crew would have seemed trivial to her in comparison to what she and her ship's crew had endured. Towing barges, weather, navigation, keeping million-dollar infrastructure intact and afloat in challenging conditions. Anne was overkill as a movie producer, which was why I wanted her with me.
So I don't remember a specific complaint from any one person. It was more of a kind of a group whining more than anything.
I mean, got it.
They were young. Just about, you know, about how you were mad at them or you weren't being nice to them. It was like, they're not appreciating my artistic abilities or anything. It was more just a management thing.
Along with everything else she was doing to support production, Anne also became a soothing influence, giving everyone an opportunity to vent their frustration with me.
I remember at one point, everybody was really mad at you. And I sort of remember driving in the van and taking a longer time to get to the boat so we could, like, talk it out and they could, you know, vent on me.
And
just make them feel like they had sort of someone else to talk to that, you know, may be able to then report to you, which, of course, I don't think I did because it was like, you know, I'm thinking to myself, what you're saying is stupid and you're immature and suck it up. but yeah, no, I mean, that definitely was with such a young crew. And, you know, a lot of this is, you know, with the knowledge that I've gained in the last 10 years, but, you know, people out of their element and, you know, maybe needing a little more hand-holding than certainly you were in a position to get because you're juggling all those technical things.
Shit going wrong during movies is pretty much the rule, not the exception. My inexperience as a director was ultimately the reason folks were struggling and feeling frustrated. I had made the technical preparations, but I hadn't prepared the people for the adventure, for the intensity of the adventure, with how I might transform.
You were a little less, nurturing than maybe you would normally be, like your normal self would be.
Mm-hmm.
Like maybe had a little less energy for guiding people and got to the point where you're just kind of telling people what to do. And, you know, I think it may have been hard for them. I don't know if I'm just making this up because I feel like I need to give you words or not, but I'm going to say this and then see how it feels after I come out. I think that people came to expect a certain person, you know, with the way you are, which is kind of this happy-go-lucky, and that person wasn't in evidence for the most part. In the shoot, you were very focused. And I think that may have, you know, thrown some people off balance because that's not what they were thinking or accustomed to or ready for. And actually, as I say, it actually feels okay. It feels like that might be the truth.
Anne and I had both been through the intensity plenty of times, together and separately. We had a healthy respect for the vortex. But we're ready to surf if waves started rolling.
That's what I gotta say. That's the part of the job I like. I mean, I like that, I like good planning, but then I also like it, not that I would ever court disaster, but I like the feeling of when something, goes pear-shaped, that you're capable of going, okay, well, chunk, 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 and you sort of, turn, make a left, and you thought you were going to make a right, and get it back going to the way we need to go.
As she said, we wouldn't court disaster, but we knew how to get lucky if it happened to show up. In episode 006, I discussed how the energy of emotion is more powerful than effort, and how I attributed the clearing of Carmen's work permit to my steady, deliberate feeling of well-being, that everything would work out. Back then, however, I was mostly a man of action. I thought that effort was the driving force. Making luck was what I did to pull my ass out of the fire. I had the sense that if I enjoyed too much luck, I'd run out. I wouldn't be able to reconfigure the universe for the really serious shit, like staying out of jail or not drowning. So my presence on the set was all about action.
I don't think anything you did was out of control. It's not like you were, Joseph von Sternberg yelling at people or Otto Preminger or whatever the guy is. Was yelling at somebody, but you were doing too much on your own, like by yourself, or depending on yourself too much to do stuff. And I sort of remember thinking about it and being like, well, if you're going to do a project that is so dear to your heart, sometimes you just can't trust stuff to other people. But I feel like you would have been helped. The whole process would have been helped had you had more technical people, like a sound guy, a light guy, somebody just help you with the technical stuff.
Yep.
Which, although it's artistically important, you can have them rig it and then, say, oh, no, blue gel or red gel or whatever. You know what I mean? It doesn't have to be all the physical stuff yourself. So I feel like we should have had more help with that, could have had more help with that, and that would have taken some of the pressure off you. You would just have, you'd put yourself under a lot of pressure. You had time pressure, you had money pressure, stuff like that.
We certainly didn't have enough people. I couldn't have anticipated losing Aji. Looking back, though, I could have spent more time in Brooklyn rehearsing with everyone to practice together the transition between who we were before Canada and who we would be on location. Between Dan Kelly, fun-loving rascal, and Dan Kelly, super-focused surfer of intensity.
I mean, I think a lot of it I had learned actually working on newspapers, where everybody has their job, but then as the deadline approaches, you have to learn to recognize who's not going to be able to meet their part of the job and say, okay, I'm going to do that part of the job. Otherwise, everybody's effort has gone to waste if we don't get to the publisher by the deadline. I mean, get to the printer by the deadline. So I sort of always had that, that in team sports was the same thing, where you have your position, but you have to be able to read the field and say, okay, well, the person who's supposed to be in that zone is over there dealing with that guy, so I'll go over there. So that was pretty straightforward. And it was pretty, it took me certainly a couple of days, but once you see the pattern of work and you see the abilities of the people around you, I mean, some people work, they want to be told exactly what to do, and some people don't want to be told, they want to be told, like, here's the end, the goal, so go out and do it yourself. I feel like I pretty much had an intuitive understanding of what it was.
So I could concentrate on the 10 jobs required to pull off the next take, and took care of everything else. Our interaction was easy and therefore unremarkable.
My memory is that we actually didn't really, we didn't interact. It was really seamless, I feel like, between you and me.
Yes.
In some ways, but that, so it almost didn't leave an impression. It was the way it's supposed to be. So I sort of don't have a perception of that. It was like, you said, I want this, this, and this, and I was like, okay, we'll go get this, this, and this.
Having Anne as our line producer was indescribably excellent. Her combination of pragmatism, empathy, and ability to stay chill under fire was key. Anne's contribution is only rivaled by the amazing good fortune we had with Craft Services, which is movie speak for catering, the sleepless goat.
I wrap up some of the arrangements with the lodging and with the restaurant.
Yeah.
I already knew that, that the logistics of just keeping people fed was going to be a thing. And I had, you know, I'd already been doing that on boats where it became very clear that a crew that wasn't fed, forget it. I mean, you know, all trouble starts with the stomach. So
yeah.
That was something going in. I knew that that was something that was going to have to be paid attention to.
We totally lucked out with that place, I think, because it really kind of glued everything together.
Yeah, I mean, it's really amazing now that I've, you know, had experience with other projects. When you get a bunch of people together, I mean, if I had to pick a restaurant for my crew now to eat at every night, I couldn't do it.
Yeah.
Because, you know, half of them are like, you know, cheese and bacon heads, and cooking ourselves, although, you know, we sometimes do it, isn't always the answer. You know, because then you've got cleanup. It's not the cooking that's the issue, it's the cleanup.
Yeah.
So I think, yeah, that was like a very key part of how the whole thing ran.
Yep.
You know?
Yeah, to be able to plug into that place was pretty phenomenal.
Sadly, the Sleepless Goat shut its doors in March of 2016. So much for our April of 2017 release dinner in Kingston, Ontario. And now, a moment of silence in memory of this incomparable co-op cafe. I'm Dan Kelly, and we're here all week, folks, every week, until the story is told, boldly, as best we remember, of the making of the longest little movie ever, Daughter of God. She's coming. She's on social media. She's stir-frying tempeh and mung bean sprouts for you. She's borrowing your socks. Her whisper is the sound of falling leaves. The sun on your cheek is her kiss. Find her everywhere. What happens next is anyone's guess. Krishna, Christ, Buddha, Allah, and all the rest throw up their hands at a perfect mess. We try to pray, curse, accuse, and confess, but we can't help smiling at the shining sacred truth that you love me and I love you, my friend. Let's meet again.
I remember there was like something about somebody snoring and people weren't getting sleep, and then there was like farting in the room, and it was like weird stuff. So